Hello, I am Magla Pillay, and I bid you a very warm welcome to this series entitled The Gita Decoded. The series is an exploratory conversation into one of India's most ancient scriptures, the Bhagavad Gita. It is not possible to discuss each and every stanza, word of the Bhagavad Gita in this series, but in the episodes to come, we will go through the essence of all 18 chapters. I highly recommend that you, the viewer, watch the series in its chronological sequence. About the Bhagavad Gita itself, it has been of deep and abiding interest to Hindus and non-Hindus, people from the East and West, and from various backgrounds. We will look at what people find most captivating about this ancient Eastern scripture. We ask how the Bhagavad Gita is relevant to the 21st century. If you have read the Bhagavad Gita, and are interested in it, we ask that you not just understand the words in the text, but to ask yourself the question, how do you honor the Bhagavad Gita? What has been the subject of endless fascination to mankind is the extraordinary relationship between human being, you and I, and God. We will look at what the Bhagavad Gita reveals about the world's most famous personality, God Himself. Who God is, where does He live, what God's task is, and what God's role in humanity is. And this is a very personal question. What is your relationship with God? And the Bhagavad Gita looks at what God's message is to humanity. About our speaker, Sister Denise emanates from the West, and yet she has chosen to immerse herself in spirituality for a number of decades. Sister Denise integrates Eastern philosophy with a modern outlook. She is a walking encyclopedia of ancient wisdom. She has a brilliant command of the English language, and she is fluent in Hindi, and as you will see, she is extremely articulate. Sister Denise has a background in media. Sister Denise has captivated audiences across the globe for many years due to her unique brand of depth and wisdom. The spiritual experiences that she has caused her and has allowed her to make a difference in the lives of many due to her generous spirit. In this episode, we will be looking at the despondency of Arjuna, which is chapter 1 of the Bhagavad Gita. This series focuses on what the Bhagavad Gita says to you as an individual, the message that is contained in it, and the meaning behind the words in this ancient scripture. Sister Denise, a very warm welcome to today's show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Bhagavad Gita is related by Sanjaya, the minister of Dhritarashtra, to him, a blind Kuru king. Sanjaya represents the eyes and ears through which the Bhagavad Gita is seen. Is there significance as to why the audience or the reader of the Bhagavad Gita sees this story unfold through the eyes of a narrator, as opposed to a third person or as opposed to the first person?
It's very significant. The circumstances of the Gita are on many different levels. The Gita means God, the incorporeal, the supreme being, the intelligence of the wise, is communicating information to a human being. And that information cannot be seen directly because it's internal. And also, when God speaks to somebody, it's behind a veil in many ways. If you look at the various different religions of the world, wherever you have God speaking to somebody, it's told about afterwards. You never actually see God speaking to the person. And I think that that is because God is incorporeal. And the person to whom God speaks is also incorporeal. The person is a soul. And so when the Supreme Being is talking to a being, on many levels, it's, in a sense, telepathic. But in other ways, you know, from the point of view of the story of the Mahabharata, Arjuna is on the battlefield in his chariot with Krishna, and Krishna is talking to him. That's very far away from any kind of audience. So from a dramatic point of view, it has to be that Sanjay is having the special gift of clairaudience and clairvoyance so that he's able to see what's going on and convey it to the Dhritarashtra. So the people who are hearing about the knowledge of the Gita, the people who are reading the Gita, you're removed. And then there are so many levels of interpretation. And this is really what this series is all about, looking at the different levels of interpretation and also how the scripture is presented from the point of view of the drama of it and the theatrics of it.
Dhritarashtra describes the battle taking place in the field of virtue, the field of Kurus. What does the field of virtue mean? And define Kurus in this context?
Well, Kurukshetra is also said to be Karmakshetra. Karmakshetra, the field of action. So you have the field of virtue and the field of action. On the field of action, the people in the world who want to understand truth, who are interested in their spiritual development and so on, they are moral people. They are virtuous people, but there's a but. And virtuous people are in the circumstances of civilization collapsing. One of the aspects of the Gita that's very interesting is it's done in the circumstances of the destruction of Dharma. And so you have virtuous people whose virtue is being destroyed by circumstances because the circumstances are so extreme at the time of the Gita. It's a very unusual time.
Mm-hmm. So, Denise, at this stage, conscious or conch shells are blown loudly. Okay, creating a beautiful sound, and so some describe it as a cacophony. What does it mean and what does it signify?
The conch shell is the bugle. So traditionally in military activity, you announce the start of battle, and the conch shells correspond to the great warriors. And so each great warrior has his own signature. And in the world of spiritual debate or spiritual discussion, you have people who are major proponents and scholars of the matter of spirituality, and they may be coming from very different angles. The conch shell can also be described as, you know, your angle of interpretation, because there are many different angles. And the big issue at stake here, if you will, is which angle is the angle that we need to work with? Because if the angle is right, then the result will be right. If the angle of approach is incorrect, then we will not be able to arrive at the destination. So there are all of these things. In a way, you can say the conch represents the mode of operation of the proponent. Because, you know, these weapons and military descriptions are also symbolic. I see. And so there's the visible war, the external war with all the military equipment, but then also the Gita is about an internal war. So you don't operate with guns and swords and spears on the inside. You have different weapons, mental weapons.
Sister Denise, you've now taken us to the next scene in the Gita, which is the scene where warriors, great warriors and armies gather together. And at this stage, the reader meets the Pandavas and the Kauravas. Could you tell us who these people are these armies that have gathered, and what do they represent?
Your background is, on one hand, the Mahabharata, in which the Gita is situated, but there are also many references to the Ramayana. So there are these two parallel epics which form the background of this huge story of the battle between good and evil and the ultimate triumph of good. But it's very complicated and complex. And so for thousands of years, people have been trying to figure this out. And we are, in a way, one more attempt to look at it. And we're looking at it in perhaps a different way from many other people, because we're looking at it through the lens of the knowledge which is given through the Brahma Kumaris World Spiritual University, which talks a great deal about Raj Yoga, about the knowledge of the Gita, the episode of the Gita. So in that approach, the Pandavas are considered to be a handful. There's five of them. So on a hand, you have five fingers, and each of these five fingers is very different from the other one. And in some interpretations, you will see that the five Pandavas represent the five different personality types of those who are focused on virtue, who are focused on personal work, who are focused on trying to get everything to be the way it should be. And then the Kauravas are 100. So 100 is a symbolic number for many. And Kauravas are essentially the majority of people who are oriented to hedonism. They are interested in what life can give you in terms of sense pleasure. They are very often motivated by vices, by negative emotions, and so on. So this is a larger number of people. So here you have a circumstance of conflict where most of the people are not at all spiritually inclined. They just want to live now, pay later, or pay not at all. Whereas you have the Pandavas who really are wanting to fight a just war and who are in this situation of having to engage in conflict because of circumstances beyond their control. There's a third group, which is also mentioned indirectly, but is very often mentioned in the Brahma Kumaris teachings, and that is the Yadavs. So the Yadavs are basically the people of European culture who are operating on the basis of science, who are very advanced technologically, and who also are part of the Great World War in that they hold very, very destructive forces and weapons, and so they also play. This is a huge world war. We've had First World War, which was relatively small, Second World War, and then the possibility of a Third World War is something that the United Nations was created to prevent. Some people say, well, if there's a Third World War, there won't be any Fourth World War. And we are in the world today having circumstances where we are capable of destroying the world as we know it. And this is a matter of great concern because there's a lot of conflict going on, a lot of things that are heading us towards situations that can get out of control.
Mm. So, Denise, at this juncture, the reader is introduced to Arjuna and his charioteer, Krishna, who come to the war on a chariot that is drawn by five white horses. Given the fact that the Bhagavad Gita is an allegory, would you tell us what this means? The five horses, what does it represent?
Well, you have the chariot, which represents the vehicle. And in mythology, you have deities who ride on vehicles. And the vehicle, from a spiritual angle, is the body. And the five white horses represent your five senses, because the rider of the chariot, the soul, Arjuna, is operating his body in the circumstance of the internal war and the external war, and he has to control his sense perceptions, because it is the sense organs that carry the soul away from itself and get us into trouble in the external world. So these are the horses: your eyes, your nose, your ears, your mouth, your skin, your tongue. All of these are the way through which the soul engages in the material world.
Mr. Denise, we meet God and Arjuna in the capacity of God being the charioteer of Arjuna. Now, did Arjuna choose God as his charioteer, or was this decision made by God? In other words, who chose who?
In the story of the Mahabharata, you have the Pandavas and the Kauravas, who are cousins. So that the war is basically a civil war. And civil war is the most terrible of any kind of war, because you don't know who's on your side, who's not on your side. You're against your kith and kin, which is a big problem for Arjuna. Whenever any military group goes to war with another military group, traditionally, you always want God on your side. And so you see both Duryodhana and Arjuna going to Krishna, who is asleep. So they go to the levee of Krishna. And as he wakes up, the first one he sees is Arjuna, who's sitting at his feet. But the first person who reached the room where he was sleeping was Duryodhana, who was right beside his pillow. And so Krishna says, okay, I give you a choice. Either you can have all my armies, you can have all my strength, all my powers, or you can have me. And so you choose. So Duryodhana said, okay, I'm choosing all your powers. And then Arjuna said, I choose you. And Krishna said, okay, you can have me, but I will not fight. So the only way in which you can have me is if I become your charioteer. So I can drive your chariot, but I won't fight. You have to do the fighting. So this is really our situation as protagonists in a war in the human world. Some people, they want God on their side because they want the powers of God. But here you have Arjun, who wanted God on his side because he had love for God. And so a very important part of the Gita, a very important part of the whole inner battle, is that if you are on your own, you're not strong enough to fight against the force of evil and win. But if you are with God, then you are. Because it is said, the force of God and the force of evil are equally powerful. But one human being can shift the balance. So if you're with God, then that makes it more powerful than the force of evil. If you're not with God, then by default, you're with the force of negativity, and so therefore you lose your soul to the forces of darkness.
Well, I'm still trying to digest all of that. Sister Denise, Arjuna chose God. And the other character, who's the pronunciation of whose name defies me, chose everything except God. Does the one who has truth wins? Is that the message?
This is very much in the tradition. If you have God, you have truth. If you have truth, you will win. Definitely. But then, what is truth? It is so elusive. It's very difficult to know what is truth. And it is said God is truth. And what God speaks would be true. So the whole question of God speaking and giving instructions and telling things to Arjuna means that Arjuna has the person of God with him, and also the words that are coming from God, the words of truth. So he's being guided.
Sister Denise, I've obviously read the English translation of the Bhagavad Gita.
Likewise.
Okay, and it is 18 chapters long. It is written in a poetic fashion. There are meters, there are stanzas, etc. Is each and every single word that's contained in the Bhagavad Gita significant to the reader? Is there a message in the way it is written and how it is written?
Scriptures coming from ancient times were always written in verse. It is the custom to do this. And the poets or the great litterateurs who were charged with the work of setting down in language these great truths, you see, if you write it in ordinary prose, it doesn't have that same caliber in the minds of people. So definitely it has to be. If you look at other scriptures of other religions, they are also written in very beautiful ways, very often in poetry. The other thing about the Gita is it's very short, it's very dense, very, very dense. And so scholars throughout the ages have, taken it upon themselves to look at each and every word and read significance into it. And I think to a large extent, we will be doing that too. And as I mentioned before, we'll be looking at the commentary on the Gita that is given through the Brahma Kumaris and also the translation of the original material, which is in Sanskrit. But historically, it has been said that over the ages, the Gita started off as just a little mantra, and then it was kind of expanded upon. So it's had this history of being expanded and contracted, and now we have the current version. But throughout India, you have many, many different versions of the Gita. So it's very difficult to know what is the real version. We have a number of versions, and people commit it to memory. There's importance given to the way it's pronounced and sometimes sung. It's all about mantras, sacred sounds have their own sacred energy, and so on. But because of our limitation of language, we've selected a translation that feels to us to be the most neutral, most academic, and to work with that in conjunction with the angle given on the Gita through the teachings in the Brahma Kumaris.
The next question that I have for you is God speaks to Arjuna. Does Arjuna represent somebody in humanity? Did God speak to one man, or did he speak through one man to humanity? What is Arjuna's role as far as the conversation that plays out between him and God is concerned?
God speaking to one person only is, you can say, not reliable. But what you have is Sanjay listening to Krishna talking to Arjuna, and reporting it to Dhritarashtra. So already God is talking to several people at once. And you can understand that if God is going to talk, there might not be hundreds of thousands of people listening, but there will be a number of people listening, because otherwise somebody will say, oh, God said to me such and such. And they will say, well, you know, that's your imagination. So I think that there needs to be a reasonably sized audience in order for that communication to be valid, you see. But how does God speak? To whom does God speak? Under what conditions does God speak? There are many questions about this. God, sitting in the chariot of Arjuna, is described in Brahma Kumaris as incorporeal God, having incarnated into the body of a person whose soul is being communicated to, and this is all taking place within the body of that person. So you have a chariot with two people in it. And then the communication between God and that soul occurs. God will speak using the mouth, and the other one will listen using the ears, and there may be other people there as well. But in terms of the picture that we have in the Gita, the other people are perceiving it remotely, in the sense that Sanjay, Dhritarashtra, maybe other people also. So it's a very strange and extraordinary circumstance in which a human being gains access to what is known to God. And if God has something in his or her intellect, it has to be known to humanity. So how is that done? This is all what the allegory is all about.
Sister Denise, I have a legal background. And in law, we speak of the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Given the fact that you just called the Bhagavad Gita an allegory, how does one read this book? I do not mean how does your eyes go across the stanzas. That's not my question. Because I've read it a number of times in preparation for the show. And it's like, for want of a better expression, an onion. You think, oh, I peeled off a layer. And then you read it again and you peel off another layer and another layer. So is it meant to be like that? How do you interpret it to serve you best? Because that's the point of reading it, isn't it? You want to be served by your reading.
You know, for me, my experience of my own spiritual practice involved initially having a desire to learn meditation, within which Raj Yoga meditation was my chosen form of meditation. Raj Yoga meditation is mentioned in the Gita. When you come to Brahma Kumaris and you learn Raj Yoga and you start to engage in the regular study that is part of the practice, the whole question of the Gita is raised, which means that you have to study the Gita and the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. You have to know the background. You have to know all the mythology surrounding it, because the teachings of the Brahma Kumaris are an interpretation of this mythology, which unpacks it and which gives keys so that you can interpret it in a way, most likely, that hasn't been interpreted hitherto. So when I'm reading the Gita, I'm reading the Gita knowing the angle that is given through the Brahma Kumaris. For example, who is God? Very, very deep question. How do you know who is God? How do you know who you are? So it's most fundamental questions are addressed, and in the Gita, it is really taking you there to these most fundamental questions. You're reading the Gita personally. The Gita is a religious scripture of the Hindu religion, but it's not limited to the Hindu religion because the Gita has informed, to a very large extent, all of the religions. So I take it as the scripture that is really for the whole world, and it is relevant whichever faith tradition you belong to. So I'm reading the Gita as a myth, as a personal spiritual practice manual, as something which gives me keys that help me to understand what I am and who I am, but also is looking at the whole world. And so, I mean, I think one does look at the Gita in terms of the current political circumstance of the world, the current condition of the dominant civilization at this time, which is Western civilization. And if you look at it in terms of, you know, there's a lot of people in this world who are totally focused on hedonism. Okay, there's a whole bunch of people who are operating on the basis of science and technology, and there's this tiny little group of people who are trying to understand truth at any cost, which is usually a very high cost. And so you can take it very personally, and you can say, yes, this is relevant to me today. And you can even extend it to say, this is relevant to us today. The world is such that we talk about humanity. Even though there are so many cultures and so many religions and so many races and so on, but we're all one human family living on one planet which is in danger. And so it's very relevant, I think, to look at the Gita in that way, that here is something which is important for us right here, right now. And so we need to get the best possible interpretation so that we can make it a practical reality.
Thank you for joining us, Sister Denise. We have to say goodbye to you because it's the end of our half-hour slot. As you've heard it, ladies and gentlemen, this is the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, what this ancient scripture offers to us in the 21st century, the message that it contains. Sister Denise has shared that this is an allegory, which means that it should be interpreted on more than one level. One cannot just read this ancient scripture at face value and take it at face value because it offers you, the reader, far more. We hope you have enjoyed today's show. And I invite you to join us for forthcoming episodes where we will be going through each and every chapter of the Bhagavad Gita to see what the message is that God has for humanity. Thank you so much for joining us, and goodbye.